never forget the first moment when I walked in Cure Cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the 11th episode of the New Revive Scanon podcast. I'm Darren, hosting for Niall, and joining me are...
Alex.
Daniel.
Grace.
And we're going to take a look at the week in Irish film. So let's begin with what we normally talk about, which is what we watched this week. So starting with Grace.
Okay, I've only seen two films this week, but the first one was Okja, which I finally watched. There's a reason I waited until I was a vegetarian to watch this film. I cried a lot, a whole lot. Probably too much for a film that was also quite funny in parts. But no, I really liked it. I love that director anyway. But I love the way it's able to walk such a fine line between extreme pathos and very kind of heartbreaking moments and then outright absurdity to the point of raucous laughter. And the way there's all this kind of clever satirical stuff in there about image and marketing and the senseless face of modern media, all that sort of stuff. So it's great. And then last night we went to see A Quiet Place, which was also excellent. Fascinating to see that being marketed as more of a jump scare, bog standard horror, when it's a very thoughtful piece, very much focused on a family dynamic, very moving in parts.
It's also very high concept as well, so it reminds me a lot of Lights Out from last year as well, which had, this one is monsters who can only hunt you if they can hear you. Lights Out was the monster that can only move if you can't see it, for example. And it has that sort of interesting thing where they're sort of literalizing how horror movies work, like It Follows did with the monster, with the rules that the kids figure out. It's,
yeah.
Like, it's invisible, but if we cover it in talcum powder and electrocute it, that will probably do it. No, I really liked it. It's John Krasinski's second film as director, I think.
Yeah, I thought it was his first, but apparently it's the second.
Brief interviews with Hideous Men or something, didn't he?
He did The Hollers, was his first feature, which was pretty awful.
So forgettable, so, debut.
Big step up
and
then.
It's Alien 3, it's fine. Yeah.
The first John Krasinski movie that you will remember, hopefully enough.
Yeah.
But no, I really liked it as well.
Yeah, you did a great job. It was really tense.
Very tense.
And it was nice. I mean, the audience last night in the Odeon, it seemed like it was a mix of a lot of people who don't really see horror films very much and people who have been drinking. So the reactions were really good.
But that's it. The joy of actually, when you're going to see a horror movie, it's great to see it with an audience because you actually get that sort of live response.
Yeah.
Live gasp.
Yeah, that you don't get when you're watching it by yourself. Like, oh, I know where this jump scare, piano, you know, violin sound, fake jump scare. It was the granny all along. I really like that it was also, without getting too spoilery, it's a very lean film. It's like 20 minutes of setup and then like an hour of sustained climax, pretty much, which is a very, very good way to pace a horror movie. So, Daniel, what did you watch this week?
I saw A Quiet Place. But the one film that I did watch on Netflix that isn't a new film is Game Over Man, which we thought we would try watching. I don't know. You know, I've been watching a lot of really bad stuff on Netflix recently, mainly because they've only been releasing really bad stuff over the last few months. And
I've
this
turned
is,
off a lot of stuff on Netflix.
I think I've found the worst Netflix film, I think.
Really?
I think so. A Netflix original film, at least.
Oh, right.
We couldn't
now
finish it. And I usually will finish a film. You know, I was literally going nowhere and we had to turn it off because I just couldn't watch it anymore. I haven't seen Workaholics, but it's the Workaholics crew. And I don't mind Adam Levine, usually. Like, he's okay. He doesn't annoy
me
too
much. Is
this
the time travel girlfriend one?
No, this is basically a piss take of Die Hard. They get trapped in a giant building and they're trying to escape. But it's just...
So why is it called Game Over Man?
Because there are these references to aliens and Bill Paxton characters.
The title
was
available.
It was not copyrighted.
But it's just the most obnoxious. I don't know. I ran out of words trying to write something that's about her. And it doesn't make any sense. The story is terrible. The characters are just so unlikable. And it has all of those 90s bodily fluid jokes that I thought were gone. I thought we were done with that.
No, they're never
gone. It's
going
on Netflix. Yeah. And it just, I read a couple of reviews, they're saying it just, that it felt like this was a first draft of something that they wrote while they were drunk. And then no one thought, well, maybe we'll do another draft.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll write it as a proper script. It just doesn't what's it's the
most That's the flip side of the Netflix model, where you get like, Martin Scorsese, make whatever you want.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, you get, hey, guys who are a little drunk, make whatever you want.
But that's it. I mean, they said they want to release 700 things this year, TV series and movies.
They're not all going to be winners, yeah.
or even most of them, statistically.
Yeah.
I'm starting to feel about movies now the way I feel about TV shows, where I'm actually never going to see And I just don't have time.
Yeah.
I'll get to see like 1/100th of them if I'm lucky.
And I spent 45 minutes watching a really bad one, so that's gone from my life.
You'll be lying on your deathbed and just thinking, man, what could I have done? Yeah. I could have learned 3 words of French in that time.
Yes. So yeah, don't watch that if you can avoid it. Please.
Desperately. So Alex,
sure.
how was your viewing this week?
I saw 2 things. I actually saw a Netflix one, not a Netflix original. It was called Friends with Money by Nicole Holofcener. I think I'm pronouncing it correctly. The director did Enough Said, so I'd really liked Enough Said. And had always sort of kept an eye out for her other works, and this had a really great cast. It's kind of about 4 women in Los Angeles who are of varying means, shall we say. There's one who's very, very wealthy, and then there's 2 sort of in the mid, you know, who have money but sort of still argue about money, and then there's for one of them who sort of decided to walk away from a relatively well-paying job and become a maid and kind of not necessarily pay attention to money in the same way. And it was actually really good, I think largely down to the cast. The 4 women are played by Joan Cusack, Frances McDormand, Catherine Keener, who's in all of the Nicole Holofcener films, and Jennifer Aniston as the one who quits.
That's a great cast.
And it's really good because it's sort of, it's slightly satirical, but not in a mean way, because they all sort of talk about each other. Whenever one of them's not there, they're talking about the one that's not there, and they all have all these ideas about how the other one should be living her life. And then as soon as, you know, that person comes in and they sort of have arguments, they go back and they all have their own sort of separate problems that they can't deal with, but more than ready to sort of jump in and give each other advice. But it's actually really funny, and the cast are really good. And it's never, as I say, it's never mean or anything. It sort of manages to be really, you know, for 4 very privileged characters, it's very endearing. And I think that comes down to a very good script where it's like a snapshot of their lives. It's not necessarily anything's resolved. It's not necessarily that things are ended. It sort of follows these 4 characters for a period, and it's really well made and really well acted. And it's on Netflix now, so I would recommend. The other film that I saw was The Square, by Ruben
Ostlund,
yes. And I've been looking forward to this because I really loved Force Majeure, and this one looked sort of similarly in the same kind of vein and everything, and I did like it. It's just, I feel strange saying I liked it, if you know what I mean, because it's so bizarre, and it's so like no other film I've seen before. The thing I always remember is when I saw Force Majeure, I was in a theater in New York, and me and a lot of other people were laughing at parts of it. It is very funny. People who don't know about a man who sort of abandons
his family in the middle of an avalanche.
In an avalanche, but crucially takes his work phone and runs away, which I liked. And then it turns out it's not really an avalanche, and the rest of the film is the fallout of that.
Dealing with the aftermath of when he's just to die.
Me and a few other, like a lot of people in this theater had no idea what to make of this, but I was laughing, and a few other people were laughing. And about halfway through the film, during a particularly tense scene, this woman stood up and started screaming at us and said, "What are you laughing at? This isn't supposed to be funny." And like stormed out of the theater. And we were all kind of like, "Oh, what happened?" So similarly with The Square, I kind of feel like that sometimes. You're laughing at something and you're kind of thinking, wait, should I be laughing at this though? And part of that is because he jumbles so many things together. He has, it's sort of set in the art world, and it's sort of, for the most part, as a takedown, a sort of satire of modern art, and particularly the money behind modern art. So it sort of plays quite well with contrasting homeless people in particular with them, the millions being funded and poured into modern art. And the modern art in the film is all hilarious. It's piles of gravel on the ground. It's a square, like the title, just drawn on the ground, but licensed for, you know, millions. Exactly.
Yes.
And it follows the curator of the Copenhagen Museum, I believe it is, running around sort of trying to get control of his life in a way and present this new exhibit. And he gets caught up then in the sort of social media firestorm because he approves an ad. And it's as I say, it's a film where you'll find yourself laughing and then be like, wait, should I be laughing? That's really, you know, strange. And there's one scene in particular that I think everyone will be talking about because it starts as, everyone's like, oh, this is crazy. And then by the end, it's horrific. Like, it's properly,
yeah,
like, oh,
I've heard about it, but yeah.
Yeah. So I definitely recommend it. It's just, it's a strange one. Yeah.
Cool. I watched a couple of films, some new ones and some old ones. In terms of rewatches, I rewatched Django Unchained, Quentin Tarantino's 2012 Slavery Southern. And it is remarkable watching that movie from 2012 in the context of 2018, as one might imagine. It's surprisingly influential, though. I feel like it's, perhaps with the exception of Pulp Fiction, Tarantino's most influential film, and that you can see its footprint everywhere from the fact that you can no longer do a straight Western. Like, even if you're doing Hostiles this year with Christian Bale, it has to in some way acknowledge the, you know, the genocide of the Native Americans or slavery or stuff like that. But even stuff like, say, Underground, which is the WGA's scripted series, which has a soundtrack that is heavily influenced. It's a slavery story, and soundtrack is, again, it's curated by Kanye West and John Legend. It's very much sort of in that style as well. So it's kind of interesting to see that. And also to see that, like, this was a movie that was released in 2012, earned something like $400 million worldwide, despite being a slavery western that is 3 hours long and full of graphic violence. And also was broadly accepted and broadly loved to the point where, you know, ranks on, say, the IMDb's top 250 movies of all time. Whereas if that were released today, there would be a collective cacophony of chaos around it. And it's sort of interesting to see how we moved on or have not from those conversations in that context.
There was some fallout at the time, though. I definitely remember reading a bit of a backlash.
Oh, there was. Well, there was the Drudge Report famously posted an article on Tarantino with the N-word printed 7 times under it. Breitbart made a great deal of hay over the fact that Jamie Foxx said a line about killing white folks and getting paid for it. So it's interesting to see in terms of the cultural conversation how in, like, 2012, that was like, this is nuts. There's no way. These people have no idea what they're doing. Don't worry. We'll forget about them. And here we are today. So it's kind of very interesting to approach in that context.
The one I always remember about that was the one that his editor, Sally Manica, died and hadn't worked on. Because I always thought there was a definite change in, like, indulgence, shall we say.
Yeah, comparing the two films, he's really since have been complete disasters,
But, like, that you could sort of see at least more of a structure even on things like Inglourious Basterds, and then a definite change, shall we say.
A free range.
More of a free range,
But yeah. So no, I liked it at the time. I actually like it a great deal more as a cultural artifact now. I think it's a fascinating glimpse of how we were and how we are now as well. And then I also saw Ghost Stories, which is the adaptation stage play, which is also out next week as well. It's opening around the same time as A Quiet Place. So you're going to have two really great horror movies coming out in the next month or so.
It's good.
It's quite good. It's smart rather than scary. It's a collection of... it's basically, it's a nod to 70s British horror anthologies. It's 3 stories, which are all very conventional and very, you know, safe and very familiar. Yeah. And then on top of that, you layer a framing story, and the framing story is an existential meditation on the idea of horror, which, you know, sometimes it doesn't gel, but you admire the ambition of it.
It doesn't quite work. I mean, you can see the play in it, and I wasn't mad about the ending.
Oh, yeah, the actual ending is the worst part of it. Without getting too specific about it, it's very easy to guess if you were to tell somebody that there's an ending that you won't like to this without telling them anything else about the film.
It was a bit frustrating because I actually quite have liked some of the segments to have been whole films. Like, I would watch Alex Noether be stressed in a car for 90 minutes.
Yeah.
And you only got to see it for 5 minutes. But it was great.
Or they hit and run in with a demon, which is a great concept. and even Paul Whitehouse as a grumpy, you know, as a grumpy sort of security guard working in an old psychiatric institution for women. Or, you know, Martin Freeman as a very stressed city banker who's dealing with the fact that he's going to have a child. I think, there's some good material there. I quite liked it. I liked it a lot. Now, I did think, thought the ending was not great. I thought it had some very sharp tonal issues.
Yeah.
But I quite liked it, I have to say. But anyway, with that in mind then, we will segue neatly into talking about the week in film news. So a whole bunch of interesting stuff happening this week, and I'm going to see if I can bring up any of it. Sorry, don't worry, I will edit that out. So first things first, the IFI Spotlight 2018 was announced today. It's taking place on April 27th. It's a day focused on the Irish film and television industry. It's a whole day basically discussing the year that's been in terms of Irish film and television production. So there's talks there. So they've got like Roddy Flynn of DCU and Tony Tracy of NUIG coming in to talk about 2007. They've got sort of talking about catch up on gender equity in there. They've got Annie Doonan, who's the chair of the Irish Film Board, sort of discussing basically where we are in that respect. And then there's sort of our artistic expression, New Age in the Afternoon, which is sort of discussing, you know, where we're going now, with a recent dramatic shift in consciousness regarding gender parity, sexual dynamics, harassment, abuse in the cultural sphere and other places. It's sort of talking about, you know, how we deal with, you know, producing media sort of in that context. So it's a very interesting discussion. It's April 27th. Tickets are available now, so you can pick them up on the IFI website, and you can order them either for, I believe you can order for a panel or for a day as well, afternoon or morning sessions. Cool. In other news, the Japanese Film Festival, which is celebrating its 10th year this year, I believe they market themselves as the only fully national film festival in Ireland, in that they host screenings in Cork, Sligo, Dublin, Galway, Limerick, Dundalk, Tipperary, and Waterford. And they've got a wide selection of films, as ever. They've got, indeed, they're taking some of the films that would have premiered at ADIF earlier in the year and sort of taking them on tour. Interesting enough, they're films that were postponed due to Storm Emma and the Beast from the East. So Mary and the Witch's Flower, for example, is screening as part of it. And I think The Third Murder as well is going on tour, which is very good. It's great to sort of bring that, bring that round to Ireland.
Well, considering that if you don't live in Dublin, there's a whole host of films you will literally never get to see in a cinema.
Yeah.
It's a nice change.
Yeah, we talked about that, like the wonders of having like the Palace open in Galway and stuff like that, and having a projector and sort of a hub for kind of culture outside of Dublin. And even like outside of Cork and Galway as well. Like these will be screening in the Modern Island in Sligo.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, as the only Sligo person on this podcast, I'm very keenly invested in. But no, it's great. It's their 10th year. They screened just 4 films in their first year in Dublin, Cork, and Limerick. And basically, so they're going back to those original locations and adding a whole bunch on top and doing 50 screenings of 17 films, which is quite impressive. So it's very good, and very glad to see that as well. In terms of other news, also Cannes. Mm-hmm. Lot of Cannes stuff. In the news, with regards to, first of all, obviously the Netflix stuff from last year.
Festival is actually kind of unbearable. Like, am I the only one who kind of looks at Cannes with complete disdain and regrets having to think about it?
I maybe wouldn't go that extreme. Like, I would be a little impatient towards it. I feel like it's made some bad. I feel like no selfies on the red carpet is a completely pointless decision. I feel like the infamous, was it high heels or the dress memo, the dress code that they imposed? Yeah, a couple of years ago was also somewhat ill-advised. But I mean, on the other hand, it's a great launching pad for film. It's a great celebration of film. Mm-hmm.
I should have to just say, I was in Cannes last week, not for the film festival, just passing through. And it's really funny being in Cannes when there isn't a film festival on. The entire place is geared entirely towards that film festival.
Yeah.
To the point where their bus lines are named after stars. You can get the Benicio del Toro bus up the hill and stuff. It's really strange, yeah.
Not even like regional stars.
No, I mean, I also noticed the Christopher Lambert rerun, the Jerry
Christopher Lambert!
Yeah,
wow. All at once, in Belgium?
And then there was the Scarlett Johansson. And then there was the
Scarlett Johansson.
It was truly bizarre.
Okay. And it's one thing to name like your sandwiches, like to have a Spielburger and Chuck E. Cheese's.
Yeah.
It's another thing to name your bus line.
But that's the other thing. I should say every restaurant was literally the Hollywood Cafe or the red carpet restaurant. And
nothing else going for it.
It would be it would be like a nice little town. It just is clearly like that's its identity.
But to be honest, if you were hosting something like that, you'd kind of latch onto it. I feel like Nashville.
Yeah.
You know, Nashville probably has a similar sort of thing going on.
Sundance, you know, that's their thing.
This is what we're known for.
Yeah, you do wonder what happens there the rest of the year.
As I discovered, not much. Everyone's just going about their business. It's just a very quiet little town. And when you ask, oh, well, what's there to do? They sort of say, well, you know, there's a film festival in May.
Do they look at you and sort of blink a little bit, almost offended at the question?
Yeah, because they sort of said, oh, well, there's a security conference on last week.
Oh, okay.
And the film festival's on in a few weeks, but what are you doing here?
You picked the wrong time.
Passing through, yeah.
But yeah, so a number of announcements there. Obviously, they've confirmed that they won't be screening Netflix films in competition. They'll be showing them out of competition because of that French rule about home media. It's basically, if you screen a film in a cinema, or if you want to show a film in a cinema in France, you have to give a 36-month window.
For VOD.
Which is absurd. 3 years. It's crazy.
I mean, 6 weeks in normal countries?
It's France for you.
It's very French, I was going to say.
Yeah, but I mean, 3 years again. Like I remember like every time I remember that I have to check it Because it's like,
it
there's
seems
no
so fairly long.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's no way. Maybe they mean like, you know, 6 months.
I mean, I would have thought they did very well with Okja and Marwich last year. I would have thought they would want those people.
Maybe
they're
resentful.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Somebody called their bluff.
Well, there is also, yeah, that sort of the Steven Spielberg-esque comments being made and stuff, in the sense that, like, even the Academy is apparently considering, you know, will they ever vote for Netflix films?
I think still films, I suppose.
Yeah.
I don't see the problem.
Well, one of the things, and I kind of would disagree with Spielberg's comments, but one of the things he did sort of say was it was about, like, reducing competition at film festivals, that if you have someone with deep pockets like Netflix or Amazon who just come into town and essentially... any filmmaker with something interesting, they just buy. And these film festivals then that are originally, you know, based on bidding and interaction and trying to work out the right distributor for your particular film, it kind of goes out the window if you have someone from Netflix in town that just says, oh, well, take everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
the mineral auction.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So maybe it's that. Maybe it's, you know, these film festivals who have been built and designed in certain ways for them. Latter half of the last 50 years or whatever, and now you have tech guys coming in and saying, oh yeah, we'll take everything.
Yeah.
That sounds interesting. You mean it's a diehard riff from the guys who wrote...
I'd say they don't even get to that. It's just like, oh yeah, whatever you need. Like,
yeah,
for the next,
I've got a briefcase full of money.
Yeah.
I've got a bunch of films. I'm sure we can work
together.
But if there's room for Netflix to do it, that means that the model is tired. It means that...
Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, yeah, presumably even they'd be bidding against Amazon.
I did think it was kind of ironic that, like, the one director who could probably release, you know, Tom Hanks reading the phone book and get theatrical distribution decided to sort of wade into this and say, people should fight for theatrical distribution.
Well, I mean, like, he has a sort of a, you know, like, he has form on this himself. And Scorsese a couple of years ago made the whole, you know, the superhero boom is going to lead to a situation like the Westerns, except this time cinema is actually going to die.
It's saturation, though. Complete saturation. There's so much stuff being made that even something that's good that gets into a cinema has, like, a day to prove itself.
Yeah.
Or else it gets yanked.
Oh, yeah.
So it's, you know, it's such a false argument to have. It's like, it's not so much any one particular type of film or one model that's doing as much damage, so much that there's just too much product.
Yeah. Well, it's also, yeah, the blockbuster model, which is basically you have a tentpole each and every, you know, week, which is,
yeah,
in which case they cease to be tentpoles, they're more
power
struts.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah, because it's funny, because then you have, like, big event movies, like, say, something like Infinity War coming out soon, and it's like, you know it's a big deal, but it's kind of not a big deal anymore at the same time, because there's been a lot of big deals for many years now.
I mean, you know, you've had Black Panther, you've had Tomb Raider, you've had Ready Player One, and it's... Yeah, and it's only March.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know,
it's kind of exhausting.
It is. And
no, this is what I mean when I say I feel like film is going the way of golden era TV, and that there's just so much stuff that you just don't have a chance to see half of it. So unless it's something you're really, well, in my case anyway, unless it's something you're really mad to see, you don't really rush out and see it, and then it's just kind of gone.
Yeah. I mean, there are great films in the past year I haven't caught up on yet because I'm too busy scrambling to keep
from last year to catch up with.
So scrambling to keep up on. But anyway, the Cannes jury will be headed by Joachim Trier, who directed Louder Than Bombs. Which was one of, I believe, our panelist Jay's favourite movies from a couple of years ago as well.
Jay's seal of approval.
I know, it's very rare.
Savour
it while you can. Don't worry, there'll be another one of those coming up in a moment. And then also there's Christopher Nolan is presenting a screening of 2001 Space Odyssey for the Cannes 2000 and Cannes 1968. They're doing the Cannes Classic season, so that's they're going back.
Love a live stream of that introduction. Mm. Do pro cinema. In a nutshell.
Nolan introducing Kubrick, just in case you
never had anything at Cannes.
He's never been to Cannes, this is the first time, yeah.
Not with his own film as well, yeah. But yeah, so that's it. And then also, because it's a 4-day weekend for many people, there's a bunch of interesting stuff happening on Irish television, a bunch of great Irish films that are being shown this weekend in case you want to set your DVRs or make an appointment. So on Saturday evening on RT2, there's screenings of Traitors and Mattress Men, which are great. Mattress Men in particular is the story of Mattress Mick, basically. And it's a fascinating documentary.
Yeah. It's great, yeah. I was actually in Mattress Mix yesterday as well. Like, wow.
This is just from the film.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's one of those things that I think I've had to explain it to people who are not Irish, how the concept of Mattress Mix works. And they're like, okay. Because you've seen the YouTube ad that he did, which is something that's like 10 minutes long.
Yeah, it's just a mini film.
Yeah.
I don't know. Does it make him sell mattresses? It does.
Well, like, when I think of mattresses, now I think of mattress maker. Sure. There's no way I'm forgetting that. On Sunday night, there's Simon Fitzmaurice, I believe, that TV3 are doing sort of an evening related to him. So there's My Name is Emily, his I believe it may have been his last film.
Yes, last feature. Yeah.
His last feature, and then it's Not Yet Dark, which is the documentary as well that's showing afterwards. So 9 p.m. on TV3, My Name is Emily, and then at 10 to 11, it's Not Yet Dark, and then on Monday night, completing the J seal of approval, is Song of Granite, which was one of Niall's favorite films of last year and Jay's favorite film of last year. Pat Collins.
High praise indeed.
It is indeed. So that's very worth seeking out. That is on Chi Chi Kahar at 9:30 p.m. Monday night. So you've got plenty of Irish films to watch this weekend if you feel so inclined. So then let us move on to the top 10. But first of all, before we move on, there's a very important announcement to make here, which is that I'm afraid it's gone. The Greatest Showman has dropped out of the Irish top 10.
Wow.
That's really sad because we have someone who's seen it.
We actually have someone on the podcast who's seen it.
Finally. It's great. You should go see it if you can find it.
If you can find it, like, it'll be a rare release. It's, you know.
Still going after 4 months.
I think the album just went platinum. Hugh Jackman was very happy about it.
I imagine Hugh Jackman's very happy about everything related to the Greatest Showman.
Skipping around the room somewhere to like it with himself.
It's a decent musical. Sorry, we're not talking about this
one. No. We actually have somebody who's seen it, which is great. I think this kind of podcast has been home to the 6 people or 7 people in the country who haven't seen it.
Apparently haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Keep bringing it up and going, what is it about this?
We should probably go and see it. Yeah maybe next week. It'll be gone next week, right?
It'll be gone next week. Like I said, in December.
Yeah. Well, I think yeah, they were counting on it being gone. It opened opposite The Last Jedi to give you a sense of scale. The Last Jedi currently releasing on home media and doing sort of the second round, whereas, you know, The Greatest Showman just released a sing-along version.
Oh, wow, right, yeah.
So there's the perfect opportunity. Okay, so at number 10 in the top 10, Gareth Davis's Mary Magdalene. Which is earned a gross of 31,000 for a total of 136,000. This is the loose retelling of the life of Christ, obviously focused on the title character with Rooney Mara and Joaquin Phoenix as Jesus, which is interesting.
Interesting casting, yeah.
I'm curious to see how he racks up on sort of the great pantheon of screen Jesuses, including, you know, obviously Willem Dafoe. It's probably my favourite screen Jesus, just because it's a strange, strange choice.
Yeah.
Not quite as strange as Harvey Keitel as Judas with a New York accent, but still.
Mm-hmm. David Bowie played Pontius Pilate as well.
That was an amazing cast.
Ewan McGregor had a film a few years ago where he played Jesus as well, didn't he?
That was again kind of strange cast. Yeah, there were two of them, and it wasn't that he was talking to himself. It was like the burning bush was embodied as. Who had the burning bush? Was that Moses? I don't know.
It's meant to be God.
That was Moses, but it was Moses. It was in God, Exodus, Gods and Kings, right?
Oh yeah,
because I mean everybody remembers that movie.
Well, it's also in Prince of Egypt is the one I remember because
that was good, and also that was good. Cool. At number 9, Steven Soderbergh's Unsane.
I mean, did everybody see this?
I've seen this.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I thought it was crap.
So did I.
Just Daniel calls it out.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's been lots of articles about how it ties into Me Too movement, and that's all great. You know, the positive spin on a film that's just kind of mediocre.
Yeah,
I don't know. It just did nothing for me. It was the surprise film at ADIV.
It's interesting because you can tell the weekend gross for its opening weekend was 36 grand, and its total to date is 37 grand.
Mm.
So I guess it's 8 grand. But yeah, it's an interesting film. I thought it was a great surprise film and not a good film, if that makes sense.
I was the same. I saw it as a surprise film and didn't know that much going into it, except some of the technical details that he had shot it on an iPhone and it represented this new way of making film. And also, I like Steven Soderbergh, so I was delighted, you know, to see the new Soderbergh. But it's a film that sort of seems to rotate through a few different things. It starts and you're thinking, oh, what... I guess it might be about this woman getting her life to... Oh, no, wait, it's like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And she's... Oh, no, wait, it's just a horror film. Oh, wait, no. And it just kind of kept doing
that. It's Like, I admire the sheer 90s sort of trashiness embodied by the filter on the iPhone camera.
Yeah.
Where it's like, in order to, it's not just like the transitions you mentioned where it goes from like a criticism of the capitalist nature of the US health service.
Yeah.
Which is something Soderbergh's mentioned.
Can't help himself.
It's a really weird through line in Soderbergh's filmography. Like, yeah. Soderbergh's really invested in capitalism and the American healthcare system.
But in otherwise relatively fine genre.
Yeah, so Contagion and Side Effects. And,
worked in Side Effects, I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It didn't work as well in Contagion. And it may be here, because the issue with it being the three films that you mentioned is that it has to pivot at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And those pivots are completely insane.
Yeah.
There's like several twists in this movie that make no sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I also, okay, fine, you can make a film on an iPhone, but why should you? Because it looked awful. On a big screen.
If you have access to proper equipment.
I know what you mean. It's like there's Tangerine, which is made for whatever it was.
Tangerine
was no
made
budget,
it had to be.
And had to be. And then there's Soderbergh being like... Hmm.
But I mean, the most hilarious thing is he credits himself as a cinematographer. You know?
Yeah.
He held the phone. He applied the filter.
Maybe because we were sitting very close to the screen, but it just looked like this should not be in a cinema. And nothing about the story or the acting. Really.
I thought Foy was great, actually.
I should say that. She was great.
But can we not have American people playing American people? I'm fed up with that.
Come over here taking our jobs.
I don't know. She's
that
not
American
bad.
Accents are annoying, though. See, Benedict Cumberbatch anytime he tries.
Oh, yeah. Doctor Strange, yeah.
Christ.
Why would you pick him for this? Anyway, sorry, I'm saying you could go see it if you read it. Obviously,
there's the full quote right there. Go see it.
You are free to see this film
if you want to. At number 8, Game Night.
I've heard it's good.
I have a really great soft spot for it. Yeah, again, yeah. Who needs a David Fincher parody of a 90s movie that everybody's forgotten? Apparently, I do.
Yeah, I'd be down for that, definitely.
But right down to stuff like the tracking shots
really?
And the movements and the. Like, the closing credits are done in the style of, what is it, Panic Room.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's...
they were good credits, like the big, like, between buildings, silver lighting and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gotta see Game Night.
Well, that's it. That's the set.
It's actually funny, which is tough. Yeah.
Well, in the same... And it is a studio comedy through and through. Like, it's got the same self-help sort of undertones that you seem to expect from comedies these days, where it's no longer enough for people to endure funny situations. They have to learn and grow and change.
And speaking of accents, there's Sharon Horgan, who gets to be Irish, which is so nice. Doesn't have to put on anything fake. And she fits in really well.
Yeah. And it's got a really, really good cast. Clemens is very good as well, I think. At number 7, Damo and Ivor, the movie. Which is pretty bad.
I was going to say, yeah, I haven't seen this, but...
Yeah, I
want to think about it. Looks particularly endearing.
No, it's not. It's
the guy's just. I don't know too much about this, but the guy who plays Damon Ivor, he's like the son of a multi-millionaire property developer, isn't he?
Sounds about right.
I have no idea.
Like I said,
he's a quirky character, if you will.
I have a feeling he's the son of the guy who wants to put casinos in Limerick and everything.
Well, don't worry, we can edit this out.
It
turns out to be defamatory.
No, I'm certain. Okay. And then. Yeah, just the idea of him then putting on
satirizing.
An accent and a hat.
And doing the Russell Power kind of bit. Like, because the inner city parody of Damo is stock or whatever, but the thing with Ivor is Ivor's stuff that Russell Power Kelly was doing 20 years ago and was, you know, not particularly endearing then, but is just reheated now. It's not funny. It's not, and it's not good, and it's very obvious. So let's move on to talking about number 6, Lady Bird.
Beloved Lady Bird.
Solid film.
It's doing very, very well for itself, actually. It's got tremendous hold, actually.
Sir Sharon and effect.
Yeah, it's earned over €1 million in Ireland to date, which is...
That's great.
That's fabulous.
Pretty impressive.
Not going anywhere anytime soon.
Which is very
well,
good.
Well, it opened very well. Like, I remember the first couple of nights I was in the cinema when it came out, and everything was sold out. All the screenings were sold out.
Oh, yeah, well,
that was wonderful.
Yeah, I was there for Adith during like Storm Emma, The Beast from the East. Like, people couldn't leave their homes, and the lighthouse was sticking up posters saying the 7 p.m., 10 p.m. showings of Lady Bird are sold out.
Yeah.
It's great to see a little film that can, and Ronan is great in this, and Metcalf is great in it as well. I think the entire ensemble is pretty good as well.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Mm-hmm. Made me cry multiple times.
Yeah. At number 5. A Wrinkle in Time, making its debut, which is a little underwhelming. This is Ava DuVernay's Fantasia piece. It's an interesting film. It's messy, it's clumsy, it's got some very bad pacing issues. It introduces its three mentor characters one at a time, which means that you're 40 minutes into the film before you get to any of the fun stuff, which is not ideal. But when it does...
What?
Who wrote it?
The novel or the screenplay? The screenplay was adapted by Jennifer Lee. It wasn't... DuVernay didn't write it. And it's also... It's based, obviously, on the book by Madeline Langell. I don't know how to pronounce that. But yes, the beloved classic, which was controversial at the time as well. It was controversial in the 80s because it tackled religion, and the film is controversial because it takes those controversial religious elements out. But which is great. It's one of those great you can't win arguments. But the issue is, when DuVernay, when the film does take off, when DuVernay's allowed to go full visual stylist, when she gets to trap Chris Pine in the Hotline Bling video, it really flies. It's really, really good. The issue is it just takes too long to get there. It needs some thematic cohesion. And yeah, it could have done with another couple of rewrites.
Do we know if it's doing well internationally, or is...
It's not doing particularly well internationally. It's
considered about it.
And the reviews were pretty tepid in the States.
Yeah.
Sort of.
That's it. It was, and it's sort of become, as any film, unfortunately, with major African American talent involved, has become a sort of a front in the culture wars. It's at the moment on IMDb, it's currently ranked 4.2 out of 10. To give you an example, Justice League is ranked 6.6. So yeah, and it is much, much better than Justice League, just in case there's any ambiguity there. Yeah, so in terms of international numbers, it has earned $76 million in the States and $14 million in the internationally, which gives a total of $90 million on a budget that is not currently available, but has to be north of $100
million.
Yeah. And when I think you factor it was because there was a lot of fanfare on the fact that she was the first black director, female director especially, to get such a massive budget, I think $150 million.
Yeah.
Thereabouts.
Okay. And you got to factor in publicity on top of that and stuff like that. It's not just not an ideal return. But on the other hand, it's probably not that big a deal, given that at number four, Disney have Black Panther, which is still in there. It's still going, which is really, really great. And it's still doing the business internationally. It's the highest grossing superhero movie domestically in the US, I believe.
And it's gone over $1 billion worldwide, and it's about to overtake Age of Ultron, or just overtook whatever was third in Marvel.
Yeah,
I'm sure. It'll never, I mean, it's not going to beat Titanic or anything.
But I mean, that's a phenomenal accomplishment for a movie that, you know, at the time it was announced, was considered to be, you know, secondary concern to the,
yeah,
a secondary concern to the third Thor sequel, or the fourth Thor sequel.
Yeah.
You know? But no, it's great to see it doing really well. It's great to see it having these sort of legs. It's earned $2.8 million at the Irish box office alone, which is an impressive figure. And hopefully, we'll be seeing more sort of along that. I wonder if there's been any edits done on Infinity War.
I was going to say, the trailer I saw recently looked like the whole thing was just set in Wakanda.
Well,
like
it was always set in, it was always going to be set in Wakanda.
Okay.
That's where the...
I believe that's where...
Vibranium is?
Yeah. It's also where the story, I believe, draws from Hickman's work, which is set largely there as well. And
that's
also... Yeah.
Great then for them that they...
They kind of happened to have that lined up. I'm just waiting for the, you know, if it had gone the other way and they had to, like, desperately edit in Black Panther into a plot that had nothing to do with it.
We were really basing it on Ant-Man doing well. They kind of did that with the first round, didn't they? I mean, it was almost as if they were, like, trying out villains, and it's like, whoever's the best villain gets to be the villain and then in the Avengers.
It's like,
and,
it's like you rank them. Because, I mean, yeah, it's quite clear watching the Avengers, the villain is meant to be, like, the Red Skull. He's the guy who has, like, the weapon of mass destruction,
then they realize,
and is a Nazi. And they're like, Hugo Weaving really doesn't want to wear that prosthesis again.
Yeah, he really doesn't. He said some stuff. The last couple of months, he said some stuff about
it. And I remember thinking, not only were you in, you know, the Captain America, you're also in, like, all the Transformers films. Like, when did you have this realization about Blockbuster? Like, what point after you cast
your
chest?
Well, he needs to do a voice.
Well, imagine after
he probably divorced quite a bit.
He said he's happy to do it from his couch.
Which is exactly what
you
want.
He had to actually show up. Yeah. You know, put on an outfit.
He's still contracted to Marvel, right?
That's the thing that's really, really kind of awesome in a way about it, is Hugo Weaving giving this interview, and I read this interview where he's like, I really didn't enjoy it, the prosthesis was awful, I couldn't breathe, I couldn't express myself through it, just putting it on in the morning was terrible. I mean, I definitely wouldn't do that again. To which the interviewer replied, aren't you under contract for another two films? To which Hugo Weaving was like, oh, they'd never call that in. It's like, okay,
well,
game,
certainly won't now.
Game, set, and match, Hugo Weaving. At number three, Tomb Raider, which is doing quite well for itself, actually, which is...
I didn't see this.
Had some good name recognition, which probably helps it.
Yeah.
I really like the Tomb Raider games.
Yeah.
No particular desire to see this film.
I mean, that's the question of video game movies, because I mean...
I could say that for about every video game.
Yeah, the appeal of a video game is playing.
Yeah.
Not watching someone else play.
Although apparently those are very popular, is it the Let's Play videos on YouTube?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Darren shows his age. It's like kids these days with their YouTubes and their Vimos.
Yeah, but it's funny, because you know how so many games that have come out recently have really powerful cinematic stories in them, that it's almost nicer to just play them as a game, because you get the best of both worlds.
Yeah, you get to experience it.
You get really profound, dramatic writing, and then interaction.
Well, I mean, I would argue the best video game adaptations actually have nothing to do with intellectual property that's video games. I'd say the best video game movie is...
Tomorrow?
Yeah, there we go, which is basically playing Mario with Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
It's like, you memorize when to jump, you memorize when to duck, you die, you go back to the start.
Yeah. Fantastic, and as you said, not... based on it. Like, a video game film is not based on that movie.
Yeah. Which is very, very good. But yeah, Tomb Raider just takes itself too seriously. It's a lot of angst. There's also a lot of exposition. I feel like it's more invested in the tomb than the raiders. Like, it's a video game movie for people who think the cutscenes are the best parts of video games.
Yeah.
At number two, a new entry, Pacific Rim Uprising.
I was going to go see that the other day.
Yeah, Pacific Rim and Tomb Raider have become two of those films, like what I mentioned earlier. I want to see them, but I'm just not in a rush to see them.
Yeah.
So I feel like when I finally get myself ready to go, they'll be gone.
Mm.
No one will look.
I'm kind of curious.
We saw it at the weekend. It's okay. I mean, I quite like Pacific Rim in a very childish way. Mm-hmm. I mean,
it's the best Transformers and Godzilla movie made in the past like 50 years almost. Yeah.
And I think Del Toro's total childish glee is what makes that work.
Yeah. It's so earnest.
Yeah.
I think that's what I love about Pacific Rim. It's just completely sincere in everything it's doing.
Yeah.
You have
guys in Iron Man suits piloting CGI Transformers, but somehow it's also very
so
earnest.
Much heart.
But that's it. It's
so
very earnest in its, like, well, you've got to find love sort of story plotting.
But it misses. There's no Del Toro this time, obviously, and Stephen S. Tonight has never made a feature before, and he doesn't really know what to do with the action here, which is a real shame because it's kind of the only thing it has going for it. Boyega is quite fun. He gets to be a bit Boyega-ish. I don't know.
Boyega?
Sure. But yeah, there isn't really a lot going on. There's some secondary characters who just have way too much screen time, like Charlie Day, who I can't.
Really? You don't
like Charlie Day? I liked him in the...
His whole thing is just, no, his face, his voice...
just day and night in this sense.
Hey.
But
some of the smashing is okay if you're probably desperate.
Apparently it's very China focused is what I've heard of it. It's like in the style of, like, was it Transformers 4?
Where they just go to Beijing for 40 minutes.
Yeah, they go to Hong Kong and it turns out that the Chinese government is much more effective at dealing with these giant robots than the capitalist Americans.
I wonder why. Yeah.
Yeah,
the first Pacific Rim is set in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
So, which was a nice touch, actually.
So, thematically, it makes sense if they go back there.
Yeah. I remember Ron Perlman plays, like, a drug crime lord in
Hong Kong.
Yeah, as Del Toro's friend. Is he back for the sequel, or is it...
Not to spoilers for Pacific Rim,
yes.
He was eaten
yes.
by a monster, but then I believe in a post-credit scene,
he crawls out.
He
spat out of the monster.
He's not in the sequel.
So. Okay.
Next
one, maybe.
The third one's The Charm. But anyway, at number one, surprising absolutely nobody, it's Peter Rabbit.
There was me thinking you were going to say The Greatest Showman.
Or
so I know that the top 10.
Yeah.
Or You Were Never Really Here. That came out, didn't it? I know. It's probably
You Were Never Really Here came out on the 9th of March. It didn't make the list.
I think, like, kids' movies seem to disproportionately dominate the top 10, possibly because of Ireland's very young population anyway.
And we're very cinema-going population, so
yeah.
I suspect
so
that...
So, in fairness, something like You Were Never Really Here is never going to crack the top 10.
Well, there's a great kids' movie. It's like, you like babysitting the kids. It's like, let's go see the movie with Joaquin Phoenix and the pedophiles.
So much for the tolerant cleft.
All right, then. So, Peter Rabbit.
I haven't seen
Nobody
Peter
has
Rabbit.
Any strong kids. You saw it. You quite liked it, I remember.
Yeah, it's good fun. It's got a lot for the grown-up people. I don't know what it really has for the kids, because the humor is quite weird.
It's James Corden, isn't it?
James Corden, yeah, who's much less annoying when you can't see his face. And Don Gleason has a great line in being
hapless?
Fastidious.
Yeah, English sort of awkward person.
I did laugh at the bit in the trailer where he screams at the pig. I thought, that's some good screaming.
Yeah. He's got really good
comedy screaming. Yeah.
Very few actors can scream convincingly at a pig. Yeah. James Cromwell is now sort of getting arrested for activism.
No, it's well worth a watch. The director's name escapes me, but he's the guy who directed Easy A and...
Will Gluck.
Yes, Will Gluck. And he's a decent director, and he does good work here with all the CG stuff.
Cool. Well, then let's move on to the new releases this week. As usual, it's a big release. Let's start with the tentpole, which is Ready Player One. Mm. Spielberg's adaptation of Ernest Cline's holy grail of geek culture, if you want to go with the
adaptation. That's probably unfair to geeks, yeah.
Yeah. That book is just so stupid. It's harmless and kind
is it
of enjoyable.
Harmless?
I think it's harmless.
Is it harmless?
I have not read it.
Yeah. Okay.
I honestly, I saw a lot of backlash to this book, and I'm like, look, I know it's a bit crap, but I also don't think it's as bad as everyone's making it out to be.
Yeah,
it's just a bit daft.
A grand, easy read.
Yeah, I felt the same.
I couldn't finish it.
Yeah, people seem to hate it, and I'm always curious what... I've been curious, but I don't really want to ask.
Okay, sorry.
Because then
you have to confront it.
Sure.
But well, no.
What is the issue with the book, in your opinion?
It seems very much... It reminds me a lot of Family Guy's sense of humour, but as a narrative plot mechanism.
It's like having a very over-enthusiastic child share with you.
It's a series of references.
Which I can see
why
it would get annoying.
Rather than... And it's very much... I mean, you could argue it's pop culture now is very much built on this idea of referencing things rather than building things. And I mean, I'm not just talking in terms of like sequels, reboots, and all that sort of stuff. Just in terms of, for example, how characters interact with each other on film. Characters are constantly ironic and quippy and referencing in a metatextual way what they're doing. And to me, it feels like Ready Player One is that taken to an nth degree. It's like, this isn't a heroic quest we're going on. This is like the heroic quest from X. It's like you're. It's a film. It's a well. It was a novel that's built primarily around. Here's this thing. Here's a reference to this thing being good or bad, and it sort of clicks a button almost.
But
it's.
People do that, like especially nowadays when. Even in terms of like film criticism and things, we link it to other things, or we make jokes, or you reference The Simpsons, or you do this. And if this is, I understand, a novel set 30 years from now,
it's
maybe we're
going to be like... It is, and I mean, it was too much for me. And it's not a bad writing or a prose thing, because I've read The Da Vinci Code.
Yeah.
I actually quite enjoyed The Da Vinci Code. I think The Da Vinci Code is a really good page turner. But it grated with me, and it was primarily that structure of here's this thing that you like, here's a reference to this thing that you like, therefore you should like this book sort of thing. And it never seemed to have its own identity almost.
Yeah.
And it never seemed to do anything particularly interesting with its concept, I thought. Or at least that was...
I think in a way that's part of its appeal to a certain caliber of people, though, and that they're not being challenged or asked to engage with anything they don't already know and have an emotional connection to. Mm-hmm. It's like... dare I say, a certain caliber of cinephiles or film goers who are obsessed with just seeing the same stuff over and over again and don't like if it's changed or reinterpreted in any way.
Yeah.
I think that's what, like, I don't know if that was intentional, but that's what the book felt like in many ways. Which, again, I didn't think, like, it didn't annoy me that much, but maybe that's why it is very irritating to other people.
Maybe. I mean, with regards to the film is actually a fairly good adaptation, I thought. I quite enjoyed it.
Spielberg being a competent director.
Well, I was talking to Niall after seeing it, and Niall's response was that he basically, what he did to Jaws in terms of quality, he did to Ready Player One. It's just Ready Player One is not as good a book as Jaws, and Jaws was not a particularly good book to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it... to me seemed to be like the best possible adaptation, but it came with a lot of the same issues. Like all the stuff is based on knowledge of things that exist outside the narrative of the film, where it's not so much the character arcs,
pieces of music.
Well, the character arcs aren't based on like characters' identities or characters' determination or force of will. It's do you know this piece of trivia about X? Do you know this? Like, there's a literal museum built to the life of the creator, and the creator has this obsession with pop culture, so it becomes this museum to pop culture, which becomes a trail of breadcrumbs, where it's like, if you can answer the right question about this video game, you can pass. If you can identify which of these films in my, letterboxed diary is actually, a date night movie, well, then we'll continue. A lot of it felt very, structured in that way, and then it wasn't a story so much as a chain of references. But I actually quite liked the film. I sound like I'm being really mean here. I really liked the film, actually.
Well, it's more effective than the book. I mean, it's much more compressed. The book goes on for like months.
It does go on for a while.
And he does a much better job of the action sequences. The challenges in the book are quite nerdy and they're not cinematic at all. So he does improve on that sort of stuff. The film's a bit too long, but I don't know. I was entertained, but mostly because I was looking at the edge of the frame for the video game character that I recognize, or for the movie reference or the musical reference. So I don't know if it's a kind of film like a watch again, because it's kind of an exercise in just spotting stuff.
It's interesting because I actually had pretty much the opposite reaction. The stuff I responded to was the stuff that Spielberg had almost poured in on top, where it's your standard Spielberg narrative of plucky, imaginative kids taking on cynical, dejected adults, played by Ben Mendelsohn, of course.
I imagine he's good as the dejected adult.
He's quite good. I mean, he's never going to... You don't cast him... I think somebody pointed out that if you wanted to make the role threatening, you cast Michael Shannon. If you want to make the role seem pathetic, you cast Ben Mendelsohn.
Ben.
I like Ben. I think he's very well utilised in places, but...
I think he's okay here, but no, everybody's doing a decent job here. Nobody really...
It's all just okay.
But I do wonder, because, I mean, the references, they're for people my age. I wonder if people of a younger generation, who it's presumably aimed at, will they care that these people or these random movies are just all over the film? Is that a thing they're going to...
Mortal Kombat from the 90s versus, this...
I mean, they've got, franchise. Like, Overwatch is in there.
And Halo's there. MasterChef pops up and stuff.
Yeah.
I know pop culture.
Is there any pop culture in the presumably intervening 30-year period between now and then?
One of the questions hinged on, like, who was Oprah's running mate in 2020?
Or something,
The plot is that Halliday, the character, is... He would be in his 50s or 60s, so he would have been
coming of age in the late
70s, early 80s, which does make sense.
But also because I think that world, like, everything's meant to have gone pretty much tits up, so it probably makes sense that everyone would live
frozen in time.
Themselves in a period which they felt was a lot nicer.
And I mean, there's a lot of... I actually quite like Spielberg's direction. Again, this is not a qualitative comparison, but it reminded me a lot of Scorsese doing Wolf of Wall Street, where there's a sense of, look at me go, I can keep pace with any 12-year-old. It's like, as the camera is whirling around.
I mean, Goodfellas, but more intense. Yeah, 20 years later.
Yeah. Now, obviously, it's not a qualitative companion, but I think in terms of, like, energy, like, moving the camera through the virtual spaces, whirling long takes, like, look at this impressive sort of setup that I'm doing.
But it did make me feel like, wouldn't it have been nice if someone like Edgar Wright had a go at it? Someone who was actually of that generation, someone who's a bit younger.
That's what surprised me when I heard about it. Like, not only Spielberg, but Alan Silvestri and, like, people who were involved in the actual works they are homaging. Seems a little...
Well, it's also strange. Apparently Spielberg toned down the references to himself.
Yeah, they would look at the renders and he would take them out as he saw Gremlins appearing.
Really?
What's
Gremlins?
I think Gremlins he's okay with because there is a gremlin in it because he produced it, but there was a lot more stuff.
Yeah. I mean, even the book as well, it's much more Spielberg focused, I believe.
Yeah. A lot of Spielberg, a lot of Star Wars.
Yeah.
Stuff they
and obviously, the Star Wars stuff doesn't come into it, which is a shame because.
They do mention the Millennium Falcon.
They do, and I was waiting for that to pay off, like Chekhov's Millennium Falcon. But then I remembered who held the rights to.
Yes.
Yeah,
they were allowed to talk about it, but they weren't allowed to actually have the things in it because.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah.
I think they did a good job with the amount of the stuff that they managed to cram in. And they did a lot of deals behind the scenes to get all that to happen, though quite a lot of it is Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
Because that makes sense. Yeah. I thought it was fun, and I would be curious to see what youngsters think of it.
Yeah. Kids these days.
It's like when they were making Stranger Things and they had to explain the concept of walkie-talkie and tabletop gaming and all these things to the kids where they're just like...
Great. Imagine a future where people have a phone that is not connected to a wall. Well, a walkie-talkie is like that, but now...
Yeah, you've gone too far.
Was it like that CompuServe review of Dunkirk, which was like, imagine the political turmoil that's happening in Europe right now, but multiply it by 1,000 and imagine Germany's the cause. That's the Second World War.
Wow.
but anyway... also out this week is The Bachelors, which is starring J.K. Simmons, Charlie Pugh, and Julie Delpy, which I haven't seen.
I read about it. It's been floating around for a couple of years. It came out in the States in 2016 or something.
Wow.
Oh, right.
It's been on VOD and elsewhere, so.
Not a good sign.
Maybe it's great.
I feel it's been buried.
Also out this week is Journeyman, Paddy Considine's second film as director.
Yeah.
It's a boxing movie starring himself and Emily Mortimer. I saw this at 8.
Did he not announce recently he was giving up either acting or making
back
films?
To be a director, I think,
Unfortunately,
because he's a very good actor.
Yes, he's a great actor. And particularly when you look at the sheer range of his filmography as well.
I didn't know he could be funny until I saw
Hot Fuzz.
Death's Down.
No, really?
I
thought he was great in Hot Fuzz. He's one of the Andes.
One of the Andes.
With that one. You'll never guess why they're called that.
Yeah.
Because they're both called Andrew.
I don't like Hot Fuzz.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
not as good as Sean
Day. No, and I love Scott Pilgrim to a ridiculous degree, so. Anyway,
But yeah, so Journeyman is a boxing movie directed by and starring Paddy Considine. Saw it at ADIF. It's quite good.
Mm-hmm.
It's clean. It's very efficient. It hits all the beats that you would expect a movie like this to follow, which is it's a story about a boxer who goes through, without getting too specific, a life-changing situation following one of his boxing matches, and basically the long sort of walk back towards trying to retain or regain his status. And it's pretty much exactly what you would expect from that. It's executed competently. It's got two great performances from Considine himself and also from Jodie Whittaker, who is phenomenal in it. But yeah, it's very worth seeing if you're looking for something sort of old-fashioned and sort of very clean. It's not particularly showy, but it does what it says on the tin.
Well, you did a great job with Tyrannosaur.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first film. It was amazing.
Yeah, really like that one.
Cool. And then finally, out this week, Isle of Dogs, directed by Wes Anderson, which is great. Another film that premiered at ADIF as well, which is a futuristic dystopian Japan where dogs have been banished to Trash Island, and the story of a young boy who travels there to reclaim his beloved childhood pet. As you might imagine, as an Anderson film, it looks absolutely stunning. It's beautiful. It's very well cast. It's got a quirky sense of humor.
Mm.
But underneath all that wonderful production design, it's also got a really good heart. I think it's something that I'm sort of so-so, actually, in most of Anderson's early work, but I really like his string of films from Fantastic Mr. Fox through Moonrise Kingdom, Grand Budapest Hotel, and this.
Yeah.
That gives a sense of...
Well, this is lovely, and I think people who don't like Wes Anderson can find it hard to get into his films because they're so stylized and so
like Wes Anderson
rigid.
At all.
But I do think the animation is a kind of fluffier side to him, and it's a little bit less bracing. Because, I like two or three of his films, and the rest, they just annoy me a little bit.
Am I the only one who consistently likes Wes Anderson? Like, they're not all great, but yeah.
I don't know. Steve Zissou and Darjeeling don't do anything for me. But I do think Fantastic Mr. Fox is nice, and this is lovely. I mean, it's very...
It's beautiful.
But it's also... It's more kind of heartwarming.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean.
More approachable.
I would argue that that was also the case with Budapest Hotel. We've always had this sort of dichotomy with Anderson between the really carefully stylized and mannered direction performances. I mean, somebody pointed out, Wes Anderson characters can no longer move diagonally. They're basically rooks. They move either across the screen
that's
or
funny.
Towards the screen.
Yeah,
but they're so consciously designed and so consciously stylized. And I feel like in his early films, there was this sort of like trying to get the balance right.
Yeah.
And I feel like with Fantastic Mr. Fox, he got a lot better at figuring out how to tell stories that were so consciously and meticulously designed, but also had a very human heart to it. Because this is a very fundamental, very human, very basic story, which is, you know, as related in the trailer, it's, you know, a little boy who wants to find his dog.
Yeah.
How do you get more basic or more emotional than that?
I think it might be about how cats are evil, but I'm not sure.
Mm.
It's more of a subplot.
It's not clear. I don't know.
It's left somewhat ambiguous.
Yeah.
There are numerous suggestions. I may need several rewatches to confirm.
No, I'm definitely going to go see it again.
Every Wes Anderson film I've seen has annoyed me in some shape or form, but we had to watch Grand Budapest Hotel as a screening in college last year. I thought it would never end.
That's the only one I'm not like. I didn't know that one. Yeah. I'm like the opposite. I like the early ones, and then
the early ones were definitely less annoying. of the ones I've seen.
Well, they're less Andersonian, I think.
Yeah.
Mm. I think he got like a shtick after a certain point and it's just unbearable.
But that's definitely true.
But I mean, but to be fair, his shtick was there from as early as like Rushmore. He just finally got the budget to be able to realize Max's plays just as...
I don't think he was quite as in your face about it though, which makes the earlier ones a bit more tolerable.
Yeah, so it's back, that's sort of a tempered... He's now at the stage where he's an auteur. No longer has to temper his vision.
He's a genre to himself. And if you like it, then it's great to have one every couple of years. But if you don't, I totally understand.
Yeah. All right, then. So that about wraps us up. But if anybody's looking to find any Rapanlis online, where can we find you, Grace?
You can find me on Twitter, at Pixie Grace. I will be logging back in from tomorrow. I was off Twitter for Lent.
How'd that work?
Grand. I don't miss Twitter at all. I mean, log back on like once a week.
Then?
Because I'm sure I have notifications.
People miss me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't tweet very much, but I am on there as at Lettermonkey for some reason.
And I'm on there at WIEAW Podcast, which I keep meaning to put more time into, and I swear I will upload more episodes soon. So one of which we recently did, actually. With,
have you not uploaded that yet?
Literally away, taking...
You were visiting Cannes. I was then missing the film festival.
Yeah, I had to take the Benicio bus a few times. And, but this weekend, two more episodes to WIEA.
You could just paste them.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
It feels like it's all or nothing.
It's a wealth.
But yeah, that's when Irish eyes are watching, actually.
Yeah.
Just in case our listeners are curious. You can find me at Dan_Mooney. I also host another podcast, which we crossed over with the When Irish Eyes Are Watching crowd. If you want to listen to the episode they may be releasing this weekend, you can go several
already
weeks.
Release it on their more efficient website.
Several weeks back in our podcast room. But yeah, until then, we'll be back next week. Take it easy, guys. Bye.
I never forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.